My name is Josh Gilliland. I'm one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks, and we are here to discuss The Mandalorian, Chapter 10, the episode The Passenger. With me tonight is Nari Ely, Thomas Harker, and Gabby Martin. So let's jump into The Passenger. This episode of The Mandalorian begins on Tatooine. And Nari, what do we see at the beginning when we're on Tatooine?
So it opens with Mando and the child getting ready to leave, where they just killed a massive crate dragon. And it's worth noting, took a giant hunk of crate dragon steak along with them to go, of course. And there, it appears to be a group of ruffians, gangsters, some kind of outlaw, setting up
Ne'er-do-wells.
ner oh, perfect,
It's a Scrabble word of the night.
Setting up a shockingly low-tech trap for Mando's speed bike, which of course does end up working. The speeder bike is totaled, and the child is held up at knife point.
They pulled like a straight Ewok maneuver on Mando.
Yeah, I mean, it worked on Endor for a reason. And was that a Jawa, not in traditional Jawa attire, or is that just me who thought
No,
that?
that's a different alien. Actually, you saw the same type on Jakku in The Force Awakens. There's a brief scene where Rey is like scrubbing down a part that she found, and a creature that looks like that like slams his, fist or whatever, basically orders her to start working again. So I don't know what the creature's name is, but
So I
same
think
species.
the early round of Nerd King goes to Tom in this episode.
So, legal analysis. We have this is like putting down spikes on the road to for someone's tires to blow out, and then they go out and mug them. Gabby, what do you think are the legal issues that we should discuss with the speeder biking?
I mean, this is definitely an assault. I mean, this is tantamount to, when I was watching it, I saw, kind of a carjacking, but not really a carjacking because obviously the vehicle's destroyed. But this is, tantamount to somebody stops your vehicle in some sort of way, whether you're cut off by, in some way, and people surround your vehicle and, try to do you harm. So we see kind of a hostage situation take place. He holds Baby Yoda hostage, which is terrible to see him at knife point. And then you see an exchange. This is in no way kind of any sort of contract or bargain, because obviously he is bargaining for the child's life, but this is not in the traditional sense that we technically talk about contracts or bargains, or this is he's trying to get his child back.
That's actually a
And
really good point, and it's sort of an interesting aspect of contract law. This idea that you can't strike a legal bargain or an enforceable bargain when you're under something like duress. So,
exactly.
had that alien not been like launched up into the sky and then dropped, only to make the best plop on the ground ever, he couldn't go into to say like Mos Eisley court and sue Mando for not coming through on the deal, because negotiating a deal at knife point is not an arm's length bargain, we'll say,
Yeah,
so
and
not an
so
enforceable contract.
I think this is actually perfect though, because I was, you might have had an initial reaction that was a little surprised because Mandalorians hold very strictly to their word. I think this was the perfect embodiment of how, under the Mandalorians code, this did not constitute an actual contract that he had to abide by, certainly didn't need to abide by the spirit of it, as opposed to the letter of it, which was he did get the
I wouldn't
He technically
normally.
complied.
Yeah, he did
Yeah, I would
comply.
say that this would be probably a violation of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing if it were a real contract, but yeah.
We have rules on using jetpacks, and I really don't feel bad for that alien. I don't. And I'm glad the jetpack wasn't harmed, because I don't feel bad. But let's get to we go to our favorite cantina, which I actually have a warm glow and think we might see this multiple times this season. if they just keep popping back in there like it's Cheers, I'm fine with that. Like that doesn't, I mean, if we could have B. Arthur be there, I would again be fine with that too. But we have a gambling situation taking place. Apparently it looks like Sabat that they're playing. And because some of us do have those cards. And we have this offer to cover somebody else's debts. Now, I don't have Murray on contracts here because I'm at home. That's at the office. But did that, any thoughts on gambling and putting up funds for someone to cover their ante, even if they are a giant ant?
My thought, it didn't work out this way, but my thought would be, you know, he performed his end of the bargain, right? He threw in, what if Dr. Mandible, which is the best Star Wars name to have ever been created, what if he just reneged? He lost the hand. He got defeated pretty quickly there by Pelimoto. You know, could he then back out and refuse to provide the information? And you know, would that be valid consideration for that oral contract that was struck right there, which I think it's the same booth that Han and Greedo sat in, mm-hmm. because I need to go back and pause it, but I think there's a blaster burn above one of their shoulders that, you know, seems to be a callback.
It was either that booth or one over. Yeah. It might have been where they negotiated the flight to Alderaan. So regardless, this is the writers and Favreau probably just giving everybody a hug, highlighting what they remember from their childhood that they get to play in this playground now. So, and I'm fine with it. For the gambling debts, like games of chance generally aren't enforceable. So gambling debts are not things that we see as like valid contracts. But the fact that money was put up for somebody else, it's just in a different category. And I don't know the answer to it. I'm sure case law, if we really could dig into case law, and I might do that for entertainment purposes, it's an interesting question.
I think you could, had this gone south, you could see Din transform into a loan shark quicker mm-hmm. than you could blink an eye. Because he's got all sorts of ways to enforce that deal and maybe ways that Dr. Mandible doesn't want to find out.
Yeah. It's like, and I, go ahead, Josh.
It was 500 credits. It's, you know, like it was a steep hand.
Yeah. And I think too, what this kind of opens the door to is, was this, you know, a contract? Was he kind of making a bargain and an exchange with Pelimoto, which it kind of seems like he was kind of bargaining for the information that Dr. Mandible had. But I think too, it could easily turn into a debt scenario, right? He's covering Dr. Mandible's debt. So therefore Dr. Mandible would have to pay him back for that hand that he gave him the advance on. And like Thomas said, he would become a loan shark very quickly. So I'm glad that, you know, it kind of went to the side, but it's an interesting question to consider.
I mean, it's also a good example of like consideration can be anything. So in essence, he's paying for that information. The payment happened to go into this pot. And, you know, the idea is that he's effectively giving Dr. Mandible 500 credits for this information. Dr. Mandible just wants it to go in the pot because he thinks he's going to win more out of it. But you know, anything can be consideration. If it has value to you, it doesn't have to be something that's traditionally of value, like a piece of property or, you know, I don't know, like a Mandalorian 6-inch Black Series figure or something like that.
Anything can be consideration, except I will note a particularly funny case from my 1L contracts law, which was sex, it turns out, cannot be consideration. There was a famous, relatively old case in which what was apparently like, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Someone's mistress, there we go, suing for things that she thought she was owed and referred to in the court filings that she had given him good and sundry things and services.
And the Marvin v. Marvin case, which flashing back to community property, which was Lee Marvin, and it's California doesn't have common law marriage, but you can have a Marvin marriage or a Marvin relationship. And that also expressly stated the consideration can't be sex. So the more you know. And that also gave rise to the famous Saturday Night Live bit, Jane, you ignorant slut, because they were discussing that lawsuit as part of that. So again, bring it all together. Now let's get into the surprise, which is Mandalorian has to take a passenger and they can't travel at light speed. And do we know the frog's name?
So this is, every time I watch one of these episodes for the second time, I will put on closed captioning and then watch through to the credits, because sometimes you can get information. The closed captioning in this one literally calls her Frog Lady. Frog Lady. And when she speaks, it says, speaking frog. Which is amazing.
I will admit that I watch with closed captions all the time.
Yeah. I found it's almost like wearing glasses when you don't really need it. And then your eyes just like lose their ability to see because they could become dependent. It's like harder for me to pay attention to a show if I don't have closed captioning on. So my attention span is degrading.
I will note that she is actually played, though, the motion capture, acting is played by the same actress that did the motion acting for Queel in the last season. So that's an interesting connection there.
Good connection.
Yeah, that's great. Yes, that is great.
Very cool. So let's raise the fact that he's now shuttling a passenger, and which means the Razor Crest is now a common carrier. And Nari, we've talked about common carriers before when we've talked about Ultra Q. Can you help us understand once again what a common carrier is for those?
Absolutely. I'm gonna let you get into any nitty gritty here, but just at a high level, common carriers essentially have a higher standard of care than other people when transporting passengers. Now there's actually been some interesting judicial debate about what that higher standard of care actually is. And there's some case law that criticizes it, stating basically that although it's referred to as a higher standard of care in the practical application of it, it ends up being kind of a standard duty of care. But nonetheless, there is a statutory higher standard of care that is theoretically applied to common carriers. They have basically, as we would expect, a heightened responsibility for the well-being of passengers in their care.
And this goes back centuries in common law, because think of a train or a stagecoach. Like there'd be a common carrier. And the legal definition, at least in California, is everyone who offers to the public to carry persons, property, or messages, excepting only telegraphic messages, is a common carrier whenever he thus offers to carry. And there's further case law that says that an airplane pilot who offered sightseeing flights to the ocean and back was a common carrier. So it sounds like the Mandalorian became a common carrier and thus owed a heightened duty of care to the Frog Lady.
Although, since he has contracted with this one individual, does that count for the part of an offer to the public to carry people or things?
I think yes, because that's part of the deal, that it's either her or her husband who has the information about where the other Mandalorians are. Thus, he's taking her. And at that point, I think it's kind of moot at that point in time for any further analysis, because she's not a stowaway. She's not a trespasser. The Frog Lady's on board the Razor Crest as the Mandalorian's passenger. It's the name of the episode. So,
sure. But at the same time, like if I, in exchange for a case of beer, offer to drive Tom from, point A to point B, Does that make me a common carrier? Or have I just, because I'm not holding myself out to the public as someone who is willing to transport Toms or other people. it's just this one time I've agreed to do this thing.
I think you look to the intent of the, in part to the intent of the operator of the vehicle. And I think, and what he tells the person he's offering passage to. And when the frog lady is standing there, albeit she doesn't really understand, you know, Pelimoto is acting as a translator. He says, I'm not a taxi. So he's, yes. He's specifically refuting, you know, to take anybody on. He's like, this, fine, this is part of the bargain to get this information, but this is a one-time thing. Like, this is not, you know, the Razor Crest is not a bus. Like, I'm not going to shuttle people from point A to point B, you know, forever. You know, it's just the specific circumstances. And I think also, I think another factor that's that needs to be considered is the fact that she's going to where he already is going. So it's not like he's going, you know, to another planet to go back to, you know, where he was going. He's taking her to the same system that this information that he needs is in. So it's like on the way. It's like, oh, I have to go here, so I'll drop you off while I'm, you know, going to, you know, X place.
So this is more like I'm driving Tom to a concert and he's paying for my gas.
Exactly.
I would point out though that in the first episode of the first season, we do see that he transports people just kind of in a different state of being, you know, normally frozen in blocks of carbonite. I think there's also something to be said to Gabby's point, which I think is a really good one, that the state of, you know, where he is in his mission right now and his quest is one where he doesn't want to draw extra attention. And in fact, he almost tries to get out of this deal when he finds out that he has to travel sublight to Trask, this water planet, because it's so dangerous. And he makes the comment like, look, keeping like moving fast from place to place is the only thing that's keeping us safe. And so he's just not in a position, I think, broadly speaking, to accept the sort of risk that comes along with accepting strangers on. And the way this episode plays out is a perfect example of that. Probably not in the way that he would have predicted, but yeah, I think he's just doing this to get to the concert, to for lack of a better term.
The issue of having people in carbonite before, like if we have to go with he's moved people before, well, we have a practice of doing that. And they are literally under his care because they're blocks of carbonite. So I think there's an argument for he is a common carrier and he does need to keep her safe. But it's, God, it's so weird. If we see him taking others, now we do.
The carbonite point was really good, Tom.
Mm-hmm. I do wonder whether, and I do not know the answer to this, so I'm just throwing it out there. And I realize it's categorically different, but say, take Uber or Lyft, where you've got someone who admittedly is opening themselves up to the public in a way, like, hey, I'm on this platform as a driver. My purpose is to try to get a fare to ferry somebody. But it's different than a taxi driver who's on a normal shift. You know, theoretically, an Uber or a Lyft driver can choose or not choose a particular fare. And they can leave, leave work, so to speak, just as soon as they've done a single fare. I get it that he's not, you know, categorically not like that. But I wonder if there's any, there's been any litigation where you've had an Uber or Lyft driver that's, say, gotten into an accident and a passenger has gotten hurt and then tried to sue probably Uber or Lyft, mm-hmm. since they're the ones with the deeper pocket, and try to use the common carrier theory for liability and whether that's been tested. Don't know, but interesting.
It's worth researching. So before we get into the next issue with, you know, moving some people, we do get to see the Mandalorian say, I'm going to get some rack time. Gabby, do you have anything you want to say to me?
I think I owe you a whole bunch of money there, Josh, because I was adamant in our discussions last season that this was a closet that he sticks Baby Yoda in, especially when he's on Tatooine, that he leaves Baby Yoda in this closet. The scene in the episode The Prisoner, where he also leaves Baby Yoda in the closet. And I was determined that this was a Harry Potter situation, that this was a closet. You were adamant that this was a bedroom, that this was not a closet, that he was not committing any parental kind of guardian violations. You were right. I was wrong. We find out that Mando can haul himself completely into this, what would you call it? Like a rack there, Josh?
Be a rack, a bunk. You know, it looks kind of like a submarine bunk. Maybe there's two levels of bunks. And again, this comes from having spent lots of time on boats. Because like when I saw that, I was like, hey, that looks like, you know, a little stateroom with a bunk in it. And it's just like two bunks, like it looked like you would see on a submarine. Like that was my reaction. You don't hang out on boats. I mean, you're in Connecticut. You could go to Groton, go see the USS Nautilus, you know, as the museum ship that it is now, and you could see that. But you don't do that for fun. So it's okay. But I'm glad, I appreciate you recognizing that.
I also like the multifunction, and I'm sure Tom would appreciate this multifunction papoose that he has that seems to operate as both papoose and hammock. And, you know, it's multi-purpose there for caring for his child.
Look, when it comes to baby products, the more uses that you can get out of one thing, as expensive as it all is, the better. I will say that the Razor Crest is coming out as a toy next year, I guess, and it had better have that little bunk bed so that I can put my little Baby Yoda figure in there and then slide Mando in his full armor, which I guess he sleeps in, which has to be really comfortable.
I just want to know if that was like a stunt person that jumps in there, or if that was really Pedro Pascal that just jumped.
Like, no, I'll do this scene.
Yeah, because it's just such an awkward little jump into this bunk that you see his foot move at the last second not to get caught on the door. It's pretty funny.
You could tweet out to him and let's see if he responds of, did you do that stunt? Were you able to hop in the bunk bed?
Inquiring minds.
These are the things that fans need to know.
glorious. So let's talk about one. Okay, Frog Lady did not look like she was comfortable where she was sleeping. So that did not look okay. That said, Gabby, I think you raised the issue of possible human trafficking. And on one level, I think back to to Star Wars, as in the original 1977, Han was kind of doing that with Obi-Wan, Luke, and the droids in order to get them to Alderaan. What's your analysis here?
So to be clear, so there's two terms that we're talking about here. So, and I think we mentioned this maybe in our conversations last season. Human trafficking involves exploitation. So that's exploitation for the purposes of forced labor or sexual exploitation. Human smuggling, on the other hand, is the movement of, is the provision of a service, usually transportation of individuals to seek illegal entry into a country. So stereotypical example of this is coyotes on the Mexican border, who take individuals trying to gain access to this country. They'll smuggle them, without identification into the country, so they don't go through border patrol. And that's a form of human smuggling. So there's no necessarily exploitation, although there can be, as we've seen with coyotes, there's exploitation for money, violence, threats, all of these kinds of things. But at its core, the smuggling is, I am going to take you from point A to point B. kind of under the guise of law enforcement, right? I'm not a common carrier. I'm not, you know, kind of taking you the normal routes. I'm going to take you kind of under the table to get you into another country that you may not be able to access for whatever reason. So I think, to me, I saw this kind of, I was kind of triggered for this for a couple of reasons, because you see this language barrier between Mando and Frog Lady, who speaks frog. So she gains passage, and we don't know why she needs passage to this specific, well, we do because it's to fertilize her eggs, but we don't know why she can't get passage, because she could have popped passage anywhere else, but she is part of this deal. She needs to go on the Razor Crest to get passage to this moon planet in order to fertilize her eggs and meet up with her husband. And it kind of sounds like her and her husband are in this desperate situation, right? These are the last eggs of their whatever, their race, and you know, they are able, if these eggs aren't fertilized, like, their whole line dies out. So, and the husband has saved enough, he's found these safe circumstances. So it really seems like she needs to kind of go under the radar. She can't go through kind of legal channels to get to her destination. So that's why this is a kind of form of human smuggling. It is still a crime. Human smuggling is a crime. It's a crime here in the United States, crime in other countries. But I believe that, you know, for Mando's engaging in human smuggling, I mean, it's with good intentions, but especially since there is a benefit to him involved, he's not just doing this altruistically. He's doing this for information.
Oh, sorry.
You may be about to say this, Tom. I was just going to add, in support of what Gabby's saying, the part where during the traffic stop by the New Republic, you know, Frog Lady starts to say something and he says, "Be quiet."
That's exactly it.
Yeah, exactly. He's clearly trying to hide from the New Republic patrol that he has Frog Lady on board. You know, it's not well explained, but we can only assume it's because she is trying to get to this planet without alerting the authorities.
I was about to add perhaps why she needed the Razor Crest specifically was they had to travel sublight, and that nobody else was willing to do that or would have been super expensive and thus not within her means to do so. Maybe that.
I think you're right there.
Yeah.
As a second important note, though, and it's relevant to the topic we're going to come to in just a second. I think, though, that when it comes to the eggs, it's important. It's important to note that you know, they were the last of her family line, but they were not, I believe, the last, hopefully, of her species, because it bears a lot on what Yoda was doing and the morality thereof.
Well, and generally speaking, we didn't touch on this issue, but it's an offshoot of what Gabby was talking about. The U.S., maybe not so much the last 4 years, but under the Immigration and Nationality Act, and really, if you go back before that, all the way to the founding of our country, family-based immigration has been a cornerstone. Probably, you know, I don't know the statistics, but I would say the vast majority of immigration is family immigration. And you know, the legal structure, not to go too far into the weeds, but it allows U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents to sponsor certain family members. And that's, you know, become a political football, unfortunately, in the last 4 years. But the deal is that if you're living here, so her husband goes to Trask, and, you know, presumably he's living on the up and up, I don't know. but say he's an LPR or a Trask citizen, at least under our framework of law, he can sponsor certain family members. And as a spouse, the eggs, I don't think that there's like a carve out in U.S. law for frog eggs, but a spouse is a preferential category for family immigration. And so that person is going to get the ability sort of to cut through some of the waiting that say a more distant relative, like a, you know, a grandparent or a niece or something like that. They're basically going to have a status that's higher on the chain. Mm-hmm. But the end result, if they get here, is they get status, they get a green card, they're allowed permanent residency. Mm-hmm. And that's huge. You know, the idea is we want to keep family units together, and that may not be that may be a peek into how they're living. You know, maybe they're living under the radar. She mentions, the frog lady mentions, that he's able to eke out an existence for them, for their family on this planet. So, you know, he could be living, you know, as a lot of immigrant families do, where they are working to the bone to make a living, but they're not necessarily, they don't have a lawful status mm-hmm. under our framework. And Trask, you know, being probably a backwater planet, may not have an avenue or an option for this family to legally exist there.
Yeah. And it's important to note, circling back to the idea of smuggling, is that, you know, with immigration, smuggling puts a huge kind of wrench in the chain, if you will, when it comes to even family immigration, because there's two types. There's coming iwi but basically you either come with inspection or without inspection. And so to come with inspection is to come, that's the traditional method of, you know, we're coming through, we reach border patrol, we have our papers stamped, we've gone through a border check. Coming without inspection means that's when you're smuggled in or somehow evade that check. So you go under the radar. And so that coming without inspection makes it a lot more difficult to gain that legal status. So if there is, you know, if we're assuming that Trask is similar to our immigration system, even if he's managed to eke out an existence to sponsor her, that he's an LPR, he's a citizen of Trask, he may have, based on her being smuggled in through the Razor Crest, and we don't know, they haven't reached Trask yet, so we don't know what awaits them there. But if they don't hit any kind of law enforcement to check them as they enter the planet, that can be infinitely harder for them to settle down into a legal status life on Trask.
I want to add that somebody's backwater planet is somebody else's paradise. And for frog people, they probably want a backwater planet. I mean, they're going to be tadpoles first.
I mean, no offense to the entirety of the Outer Rim. Lots of good people live.
But no, I get what you're doing there, Josh. I do.
Okay, good. Good.
Nuri, you're effectively from the Outer Rim of the United States, so please don't be offended at my slight toward Trask.
I will say that a majority of Firefly looks like it could have been shot in Arizona. So yes, I think I come from a backwater.
And speaking of Firefly, this episode of the Razor Crest really looked like Serenity a lot.
Oh yes, I have thought it looked like Serenity from the beginning, and I know that there's probably good reasons for that, other than that it, you know, was inspired by Serenity, but you know, it has a special place in my heart.
I'm not complaining, but it just, like, that's oddly familiar right now. Anywho, let's get into some of the other issues here, because I do like the human smuggling aspect, because you think of, you know, like fall of Vietnam and people who crossed the Pacific, and that was a long boat ride to get to the United States, big ocean. Or those who have escaped Cuba, or those who, you know, try to get to the United States hiding in the back of trucks, you know, to get away from horrible situations. It highlights why we need why we have refugee laws, why it's an international right, and it is a fascinating one. So so after Gabby tweeted this out, and since we're live, so those who listen to this, you know, we do have, question that says, can you please address the legal issue of Mando allowing Baby Yoda to eat a near extinct passenger's baby eggs for the entire episode? Like, is there a duty of care there? And I do want to highlight, as this gets into some parenting issues, that as soon as you see your kid eating something that he shouldn't be eating, we do have that immediate response. They weren't fertilized eggs. But this is super disturbing. And Tom, as the only parent here, what was your reaction to this? And have you had similar moments with your children?
My kids have not eaten, you know, the spawn of some Star Wars creature yet, but I completely related to the moment where he like discovers Baby Yoda doing this and he shuts the can. He's like, don't do that. And the tone is one of like, oh God, what if somebody saw this? And I completely get that as the parent of a 2-year-old. But yeah, there was a weird, I feel like we don't know, and you know, we're not a speculation show, but I feel like we don't know the entire picture here, because there's that weird moment that Baby Yoda has with the eggs when he first sees them, that like the music gets very different. And then he comes up and puts his little cute hand on the glass, and that the eggs almost look like they sort of float toward him. It could just be a scene like a kid seeing cake or something, which is horrendous to think about, but you know, perhaps there's something bigger at play. I don't know.
I just want to point out that, like, you know, we have yet to see the ultimate conclusion of this storyline, if they're going to show it to us with, like, you know, a reunion with the husband or something like that. But when I first saw the scene where Baby Yoda's looking at those eggs, I was like, oh God, he wants to eat them. My boyfriend who was watching with me was like, no, no, I'm sure it's just he thinks they're precious and cute. And no, I was unfortunately
5 seconds later.
Yeah. Whoops. But yeah, I do want to point out just to get to the, I think, you know, a little more of the crux of the viewer question here. So, you know, the closest analog I think we would have in our existing law would be like cannibalism, because like, yes, this is not the same species, but it is sentient life. It's, you know, eggs. It's part of, you know, it's part of the frog lady, even if they haven't been fertilized yet. And, you know, if I could be wrong, but I believe that most definitions, even ardently pro-life definitions of life, usually start at conception. So at least I'm pretty sure those aren't fetuses, but they probably count as, you know, human flesh in the sense that they're sentient, potentially sentient life. And interestingly, there isn't really any law in the United States directed specifically at cannibalism. However, most desecration of corpses law covers that. It's just gross. I'm sorry, guys. This is just like really gross.
When you see this, like the in-story significance of it, because it's not like he reacts when Baby Yoda eats a frog, right? There's a very different reaction in Mando because he knows the stakes are very different here. And I don't know whether, I think, Nora, you may have already made this comment, but I think the eggs that we're talking about are the last of her family line, not the last of this species. But still.
I mean, I'm sure it could be interpreted otherwise, but I think that's
yeah. What but still, he understands. I think one of the great things about this episode is he understands the stakes for her. Whether it has an impact on the species writ large is another question, but he knows they're important to her. And, you know, going back to that common carrier liability, you know, the last thing that he wants is to get to Trask with his ship all banged up and then get immediately sued for, you know, intentional or negligent infliction of emotional distress.
Yeah.
Or something
oh yeah.
Like
that would be pretty good. Although Baby Yoda did not eat those in front of her. Right. And I believe that's mm-hmm. actually like the personal witnessing of it, I believe, is an mm-hmm. important factor in that. I do want to add just one more thing to this discussion, which is just not necessarily legal, but just specifically about the child, which I found interesting, is that this kind of like with the frog was a more poignant example, in my view, of also how the child is really a child in the sense that Baby Yoda does not have this already ingrained sense of this is good, this is bad, this is evil, those kinds of things. And he clearly needs to be taught quite a bit about morality and ethics. This one being, you know, in particular, I understand these are delicious, but you still cannot eat them.
He saw it as snack time. And as any little kid will, if there's like, oh, cupcakes, and like they're smashing cupcakes into their mouth and the frosting's everywhere. Like it's like that. But it's someone's potential kids that Mando's technically responsible for because one, he knows it. Two, that's why she's on the slow boat to Trask. And all of that's just Like, you know, granted, I did get up at 4 a.m. to watch this because that's the world we live in. You know, I go to bed watching Star Trek Discovery Thursday nights. I wake up Friday mornings and watch Mandalorian, and all is well in the world. It's a good time to be alive right now. But my God, yeah, I was disturbed watching this. From the knife being held to the child eating somebody else's eggs. I was like, oh God, please stop. This can't be happening.
But I think it was supposed, you're supposed to be disturbed. It's supposed to show that Baby Yoda still needs some good moral education.
He's a baby.
I think what's interesting though, and this is, you know, kind of to the point that's already been made, is we don't know the conclusion of this story. And I think other speculation sites have pointed this out, is that Baby Yoda ingests the whole thing. He just kind of like pops it back in his mouth and swallows it whole, as opposed to, you know, when we've seen him eat the frog, and when we've seen later in the episode when he eats the spider thing, that he chews it. So clearly this is a different kind of ingestion process, and the eggs, the fact that the eggs seem to be drawn to him, which I love the fact that his little nose was smushed against the glass. that just warmed my heart on so many levels. I mean, this is a puppet and its nose was smushed against the glass. But anyway, to Nari's point, I think what's interesting is the fact that you mentioned that Baby Yoda clearly doesn't know right from wrong. And if he did get to Trask, and this is considered, you know, considered murder of unborn life, or, you know, because even though the eggs aren't fertilized, they're still viable. They're, in the words of Roe v. Wade, they're potential life. So if he is considered that he's eliminated these potential lives, he can't be held responsible, because the whole fundamental criminal justice system, and this is kind of throwing it back to 1L crim law, is that our criminal justice system is there to deter people. So you have to, the basis of punishment in the criminal justice system is that you have to have that sense of right and wrong. You have to have that understanding in order to be punished, because if you don't understand right from wrong, I mean, that's why we have an insanity defense, is you can't be punished. You can't, the punishment is not effective on you because you don't know the difference between right and wrong. So if he did end up going to Trask, Baby Yoda can't be held responsible. He's too young. He doesn't understand what he's done, the implications of what he's done. So then Mando would be on the hook for whatever nefarious things he's done.
I think the only saving grace here for Baby Yoda / Mando would be that, you know, Frog Lady does not appear to notice yet that some of her eggs are missing. So let's hope that continues.
To your go ahead. Tom. No, to your point, Nari, you were talking about intentional infliction of emotional distress. While she doesn't see this instance on the Razor Crest of popping back the eggs, I think you could argue that she does see them when she's in the hot tub, spring, whatever that is, because she's right there and he tries to pop one back.
Presumably she can count too.
And there's, well, that's what I'm saying. I'm hoping that she actually is not keeping track, because otherwise Mando is in for an earful of frog language.
And there's that moment right at the end where Baby Yoda is looking at her, and right before she goes to sleep, she just kind of clutches it a little tighter. So I think she knows something's up.
So one of the viewer who's interacting with us on Twitter made a comment about cannibalism at sea. And I, you know, again, getting into my boating knowledge and maritime history, let's talk about the custom of the sea. That was, you know, you're in the lifeboat and you're out of food, and then you draw straws to see who gets killed to be food. And there's some consent there. There's not like, we're gonna murder Jerry and barbecue him that there's a drawing of straws and everyone's willingly participating on who gets to die to feed everybody else. Or you get the crash plane in the Himalayas, known in, you know, immortalized in the film Alive, also made into a movie about, I don't remember what sport team crashed, but they had to eat some players. And they were already dead. So I think it's a little different here because it's a different category because it's not how life works for us as a sentient species. Gabby, hit me.
I am so excited that this person, and I kind of thought of this when we mentioned cannibalism, because this is like the one thing I think of with cannibalism, because it was very traumatizing to go into my 1L crim law class, and this is the first case we read.
Are you serious? Martin,
with the great Martin Margulies of Quinnipiac University School of Law, which is Regina versus Dudley Stevens. This is the famous case of cannibalism at sea. I'm pulling up the case now because I cannot remember the outcome, but basically it was it a necessity to commit murder at sea to survive? So I am just so excited that this person called back, and hopefully that's what our viewer was thinking about, was Regina for Dudley Stevens. So
the only necessity here, oh, sorry. The only necessity here is that Mando buy a healthy supply of snacks, because as a parent, that's the one thing that you need. You like cookies, pouch, whatever you need, you just have an ample supply of. He created this entire problem himself.
I just wanted to point out for our viewers also, when you are not on international waters, however, consent is not an excuse to murder. There is no element of the murder crime that involves that they must have not wanted to die.
Yeah, but true. But again, it's called the custom of the sea.
Just as a little side note.
I'm not saying that if we go to a Comic-Con and things go to hell and we're out of food in Hall H and somebody needs to die, I'm not saying that's the right call. Like, I'm saying we're going to wait to get rescued and someone doesn't end up getting hit with a boot, you know. Look, like, it's
if I'm in the group, you can count on me to have a random, maybe a little stale bag of Cheerios or some fruit snacks on me somewhere.
Oh yeah, parents are going to be all set. They'll have lots of snacks on them.
Yeah, you guys will be okay. I'll take care of you all. Orange slices, juice boxes.
Which I just looked it up, and the holding of Regina v. Dudley Stevens, I won't give in to how my dear Professor Margulies used to pronounce Regina. I will leave that up to your speculation. But the holding was, yes, it is murder. The necessity of hunger does not justify murder. So Regina v. Dudley Stevens stands for the principle that you cannot commit cannibalism. It is still murder, folks.
So the the mantra from Arrested Development of go to the sea, that's not right. just not right. As much as I love Henry Winkler, that's not right. So, boy, howdy.
Should we steer this conversation back towards other things now?
I did not
see us going into a deep dive on cannibalism in international waters, but here we are.
Yeah, it's, you know, the more you know. So let's get into...
That's what you get for avoiding a tirade on snow spiders, Tom.
I was worried about several of my female friends who don't like spiders about this episode.
Does Tom have a thing about space spiders? I'm just curious. I have not heard this before.
Did something happen in Iraq you haven't told us?
Not a big... I'll say, look, when I see a spider around the house, I know that it's doing its job, but I don't have to be happy about it. I'm not saying that I like go after them. I'm just saying that, you know, I will resort to deadly force. probably more quickly than I do against other bugs.
So I take it you're not a fan of arachnophobia. So that's
I also classify myself as a pretty serious arachnophobe. I have the unfortunate side effect, though, of instead of having, you know, seeing an eight-legged creature and feeling a murderous impulse, if it's sufficiently large, my unfortunate instinctual reaction is just to freeze. So, like, it happened once. This is a really random side story. I'll try to make it short. It happened once that I was out on a hunt in a village in Sierra Leone, and I was hacking through the jungle and looked up, and I swear to God, there was, like, a spider the size of my face about 2 feet away hanging between two branches. I just ended up standing there staring at it because I couldn't move. One of my friends comes over and is like, Nari, what are you staring at? And is like, oh God. And it's like, looks at me, he's like, do you want to move away? And I'm like, yes. And so just, like, moves me away.
I just want to know, I just want to feel, like, confident that this episode, like, assuaged my fear, it confirmed my fear that when you kill one spider, its kin comes for you.
They're coming for you. The big daddy or mama, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. So that is a constant fear I have. When I kill one spider, there is a family of spiders waiting for me.
They're gonna find you.
So let's, before we get into the spider issue, so we have X-Wings. And God, I love seeing X-Wings. And was that, was it White Wolf? You know, what
Trapper
was that?
Wolf.
Trapper Wolf.
He's back, baby.
Yeah, it's good to see Dave. It's good to see Dave living out his dream that everyone who's loved Star Wars for the last 45 years is just absolutely giddy over. Let's talk about traffic stops of spaceships. So there's a variety of ways to look at this because Space Force doesn't exist yet. So, and because, you know,
don't tell the administration that.
So first off, they say, like, hey, turn on your transponder. And I learned to fly a plane before I could drive a car because I'm that guy. And transponders are important. So it's federal law that civilian aircraft have to have a transponder. And they give out a variety of information like your ID number, altitude, things like that. So that way we don't have congested skies. We just don't have airplanes flying around and control towers having no idea what's going on. So yeah, you know, like, it's federal law to have a transponder. We have Coast Guard boardings, and that's something that else that's, I think, could be comparable with spaceships. And for the Coast Guard to do a normal vessel boarding, that is, they don't need to do Miranda. It's not technically an arrest. But if this is more like cars and not ships at sea, we're in a different world. And Gabby, you did a bunch of analysis on this. Your thoughts and what you put together.
Yeah, no, and I love going back to our debate over whether it was a closet or a room. When you saw this, you immediately thought of Coast Guard boarding and airplanes and all of that good stuff, and possibly Space Force. I thought of the traditional traffic stop of, you know, police rolling up next to you, saying, you know, show us your license and registration. And that's, to me, what this was. This was a traffic stop in space. So in the United States, a police officer can't stop you. A traffic stop of a vehicle in detention is a seizure for Fourth Amendment purposes. Again, Fourth Amendment purposes prohibits unlawful searches and seizures. A routine traffic stop is justified if the police officer has reasonable suspicion that the occupant is unlicensed or the vehicle is unregistered. The officer doesn't need reasonable suspicion to stop your vehicle if they believe you're involved in criminal activities. Here, this would be a first case. So they believe it's a routine stop. This, to me, this is the equivalent of a DUI checkpoint, right? In a DUI checkpoint, you're driving along, an officer can stop you, they can pull you over to the side of the road and just ask for routine items. So this is kind of a checkpoint scenario. And I believe they even say that, you know, oh, we're scanning the area for Imperial remnants. So this is, you know, very routine. And they have reasonable suspicion to make sure that this person is not involved, is not an Imperial remnant, is not, which is why they kind of ask him for his identification. He says it's the Razor Crest. And this is not, you know, the kind of search stop where there would be able to search the vehicle, right? So they need a heightened reasonable suspicion of criminal activity during the stop to give rise to a search of the vehicle. What I thought was particularly interesting for me, and this would be another question for Pedro Pascal, I found it very, very interesting that if you're watching this, the footage of him stopping, you know, while he's engaged in this stop with the space police, he has his hands on what it would be the dashboard or the steering wheel, which is something that people of, you know, Mando is played by Pedro Pascal, who is a person of color. You know, a lot of people of color are taught that you put your hands on the dashboard, on the steering wheel, to not have any sort of negative interaction with police. So I thought that little detail, I don't know who's, if that was just something that happened, but I thought that was a very little interesting detail.
In, you made the comment about a DUI. In North Carolina, they have it's DWI, driving while impaired. And this particular scene, I think they would, the New Republic can have DWIs. It's just driving with Imperials, since they seem to be keenly interested in finding Imperial holdouts here. I thought this was the most fascinating and best part of the episode for me, because the peek into the way in which the New Republic is operating and enforcing laws, even on the outskirts of the galaxy here. They've deemed it necessary to send a pair of X-Wings to patrol. And, you know, presumably if they're searching for craft traveling sublight, you've got Imperials that are just out on the lam, you know, trying to evade detection at this point. And what's really awesome about the Trapper Wolf being brought back in, we saw him last season in the Prisoner episode at the very end, as the X-Wings show up at that space station. And to Gabby's point, you talk about a reasonable suspicion here. There's that awesome moment where Trapper Wolf radios over to his co-pilot and says, or his wingman, and he says, you know, hey, can we switch over to another channel? And you just know what's happening. And then you see the S-foils open on both X-Wings. And that's like, I guess the X-Wing, the Star Wars equivalent of, you know, the blue lights going off. Yeah. And then they ask the question, hey, were you involved, you know, were you ever near a prison ship, blah, blah, blah. And then the chase starts.
Yeah. But I interpreted that the X-Wings getting into combat mode is the equivalent of like a police officer while making the stop, you know, unbuttoning that little clip on their firearm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not quite pointing it at you yet, but they're getting ready.
And it's interesting how that really changes the tension of this stop, right? Because a stop can just go from, hey, like your taillight's broken, to flipping the holster, possibly drawing a weapon. And that kind of changes the whole temperature of the engagement with police, which is, you know, then when you see him kind of do the dive into the planet, which is a maneuver to evade police. I mean, unfortunately, that's what he's doing, and that is a crime to evade police. And the elements of the crime of evading a police officer, the police officer has to be pursuing you in a motor vehicle, which here we have a space vehicle. you were also driving a vehicle when you willfully fled or tried to evade the pursuing police. which he is driving a vehicle, a space vehicle, and he willfully flees, right? He immediately hears the prison transport and he's like out of there. And then the last element is that the following has to be true. The police officer's vehicle had at least one red light visible from the front. You saw or should have seen the red light. The police officer sounded the siren. The vehicle was distinctively marked as a police officer's vehicle, and the official was wearing a police officer's uniform. So this element is to give that you knowingly fled from a law enforcement officer. So clearly these are agents of the New Republic. They've identified themselves as New Republic officials. They're flying X-wings. That's basically, you know, the law enforcement vehicle of, you know, fighter vehicle of the galaxy. And I'm sure if you zoomed in to whatever Arabesque letters are on their X-wings, you could see what their identifications are. And they're obviously in their X-wing pilot uniforms. So they are law enforcement officers. So he knows who he's fleeing from. It's not like, some black car pulled up behind me and I wasn't really sure who they were, so I just like kept driving. No, he knows who these people are, and he's
could have been flying that X-wing. Those things are all over the galaxy. I like how you can just replace some of these, some of this language verbiage that you laid out there in the elements with Star Wars language. Like, you saw or should have seen the red light. You saw or should have seen the S foils locked. The police officer sounded the siren. The New Republic pilot gunned
pilot hailed your vessel with a cease and desist.
I wanted to flip that question to Tom and Josh of, you know, would they have, you know, because now we kind of move from, you know, shooting a traffic stop to a real kind of aerial chase situation, which is they tell him several times that they're going to shoot him out of the sky. So would they have the authority to shoot him out of the sky based on his interaction?
So it depends on what like framework you're looking at. If you're looking at it from a law of armed conflict framework, certainly there are instances abroad like Afghanistan, Iraq, where U.S. forces interact with just criminals, not necessarily an enemy or a combatant. It's just a straight criminal. And that's, you know, we're not directly there to enforce any like local laws, but, you know, sometimes this sort of stuff happens. I think it's fascinating that in this scene, the X-wing pilots illustrate restraint there. The key for me is normally when you talk about, a non-uniformed, unlawful type combatant triggering the use of force, you look for something like hostile intent or a hostile act. The simple act of fleeing in and of itself is not a hostile act, and nor would it be hostile intent. And so I don't know that they would have the ability to use like deadly force under that framework. The question then becomes like jurisdictionally, and this goes broader than the law of armed conflict that I'm talking, but jurisdictionally, this is in the Outer Rim. This is not in the sort of sovereign space of any New Republic planet. Really, the only hook that the New Republic has to go after him is he doesn't have a transponder. It's like the equivalent of not having a taillight functional in a normal car. And B, that he has some connection to an attack on a New Republic vessel where a New Republic officer died. And so in that context, I think his actions might warrant the use of force to detain, to bring somebody into some sort of custody, but not necessarily to destroy unless the facts change there.
I agree with that. So my reaction was from the Coast Guard perspective, because these are X-wings, they're military. The only military branch that we have that's allowed to do law enforcement is the Coast Guard. And if not, we're violating posse comitatus by having the military conduct law enforcement. And that was born after you know, the Civil War, it ended Reconstruction. And also the other fact was when we had the Army put down the Great Railroad Strike, that tended to really upset people when you have the Army shooting protesters. Kind of like throwing moms in the back.
Say.
Yeah, for some reason, shooting a mom with tear gas and then tossing her in the back of an unmarked vehicle upsets people.
Oddly mom, relevant once again.
I know. If you want to, if you want the mom vote, don't do that. Digress. So, which is why I thought in terms of Coast Guard with something comparable, because that at least makes sense with, that we have military doing quasi law enforcement, quasi military type actions, because they're looking for Imperials. They're not enforcing like revenue taxation. So it's, we're not like playing revenue cutter, again, free Coast Guard, Alexander Hamilton type stuff. And so we're not firing on rum runners. We're trying to make sure that we don't have Imperials because space Nazis are bad, just like all Nazis. And they don't want them running around forming like a new counter-strike and say blowing up planets. They went through some unpleasantness. So that first generation after the war is not going to tolerate that. So that's why they're out there. So the Coast Guard generally doesn't use lethal force out of the gate. Like the guys in, you know, deployed in to stop drug trafficking off of Florida, you know, they have the helicopters go out and they have a, you know, big 50 caliber weapon that they use to put a round through the engine block of the speedboats that are taking drugs in. That's not doing a full-on airstrike to blow the boat out of the water. When we see those little quasi-submarines, they don't openly sink them, they capture them. So I think the New Republic X-Wings are more into that category of enforcement. That's military doing law enforcement type activities that have a foreign policy mix to prevent the Empire from coming back and to hunt down war criminals. So I think it's, you know, like late 40s, early 1950s style. If Germany had still had people running around, or the Japanese had, you know, say submarines that refused to surrender, and they're still running around the Pacific. So I think that's the category that we're in here. And Nari, it looks like you're about to speak.
Yeah, I was just going to draw one more parallel here, which is I think this is less, although, you know, the comparison of the Empire to World War, you know, and the conflict between the Empire and the rebellion to World War II is well taken. I think, you know, in particular, the Mandalorian being the kind of Western style that it is, and these being very, you know, far outlying planets, this is very much more like the old West, where mm-hmm. the New Republic, such as it is clearly not extended its sort of law and order to these planets yet. And so what you have is a place where, as we saw in the last episode, townships are electing their own marshals and giving them law enforcement abilities. And as often happened in the old West of the United States, the military would sometimes be relied upon when there were significant groups of outlaws that the townships couldn't deal with themselves. And so I think this is actually, you know, very much in character for the Mandalorian, that we have two military vessels flying around patrolling the Outer Rim, because there just isn't a New Republic seat of government here, as far as we can tell, and certainly no dedicated police force that's patrolling Tatooine.
Yeah, and I would call back even to, and I wrote a whole article on this after Rogue One came out on the Legal Geeks blog, but I would call back to the legal framework around Vader's boarding operation of the Tantive IV, and the legal justification there. And you know, Josh touched on these maritime interception operations generally, and here, you know, whether they're in the core or not, or some wild part of space, you know, in the real world, whether they're just off the coast of Florida or out in international waters, international law and our law recognize certain situations where you can chase down, stop, and then board and search a vessel. And one of those that the UN recognizes is the prevention of terrorism, right? So you've seen that a lot off the east coast of Africa with anti-pirate operations and whatnot. And I think the chase, the initiation of the chase and the tie to the attack on this prison ship is all the hook that the X-Wings and the New Republic need to go after and force this, force the Razor Crest to ground. Because theoretically, there were other prisoners on that ship. There were Imperials that we saw, at least one former Imperial that was imprisoned. It was arguably a terrorist attack on this ship to free, somebody that was imprisoned for some bad things. And so, I think you could stretch that legal theory, and they've got all the justification they need, no matter where they are in the galaxy, to stop that ship.
Well said and well debated. I would just toss out, after the Civil War, we did spend time catching Confederates. Including Jefferson Davis. They a bunch of them did go out on the run. I don't know how many years that went on, if they escaped out west and were hiding. So that would be an interesting history project to go, how long did we chase them?
I will make a plug. So Dave Filoni got the attention here as the pilot, but the other pilot, I will plug this TV show. He stars in a show called Kim's Convenience, which you can watch on Netflix. It's a sitcom. It's a Canadian sitcom at that, but it is very, very good. He plays a Korean father who runs a convenience store, and he is delightful, as is the show. Great. And the actor,
I didn't recognize him.
Oh yeah. The actor himself is a huge Star Wars fan and a huge Star Wars cosplayer, and is absolutely worth the follow on Twitter. He'll probably follow you back and interact with you, but he's got all sorts of costumes and whatnot. I think he probably wore one of his own costumes on the show. They didn't need to provide him with anything, but so check that out.
That's beautiful. That's so awesome.
What I loved about, and this may be jumping ahead a little bit too much, but this is kind of interconnected with the X-Wings, is I loved the kind of archetypical moment when Mando's good deed from last season comes back to save him, right? This is the classic story of one of a band kind of does something that everybody else is like, why are you doing that? Like, why are you helping this person? Like, they're doing something that's to their detriment, but it's to save the little guy. And this comes back and saves him, right? This is why they shoot off the spiders. It's why they assist him. And because he saved, he didn't end up saving him, but he fought for the life of the prison guard. And that's like a huge thing. And it was a small thing that ends up saving him now. So I just, as a literary person, I love that little callback and that little, moment of a very basic kind of narrative storytelling.
I also love that they did not help him repair his ship.
Yeah, yeah.
They saved him and left.
They're like, debt paid. Goodbye.
Get that taillight fixed.
It didn't turn into a beer commercial. Yeah, everyone, it's like, look, the wagon's broken. Like, they all didn't chip in to fix the wheel. It didn't end as the Michelob commercial. And that was good. I did like the cavalry, and I enjoyed the basically prosecutorial discretion. It's like, was that you? Yeah. Thanks. And turn on your transponder. And they flew away after killing the giant spider. It was perfect. So I just have a sense from a storytelling perspective this season, each episode is going to begin as kind of a postscript to the episode before. And I wouldn't be surprised if the next one begins with them getting to Trask. And
I really hope so. I was waiting. I was so looking forward to seeing Frog Lady meeting Frogman. Because I don't know about you guys. I assume you guys feel the same. She really endeared herself to me throughout that episode.
Yeah. That's a great example of bringing real character out of an alien. I would compare it to like Chewbacca levels of emotion and whatnot that they were able to achieve.
And I want to also credit the show for how creative they were with also when she really needed to book it, she started running on all fours like a frog.
Yeah.
Yep. She could get dressed fast. That was impressive. Yeah.
That was awesome.
And so good job there. And again, I was about to say the hopping was like, wow, she's hopping. Yeah. That's nice.
And yeah. I think too, one thing that struck me was the realism that, you know, Mando gets knocked out as soon as they crash through the ice. And when he wakes up, she's freezing. And he's like, I need to get blankets on her. Like, that would happen to a real frog. Like, that was so cool.
Cold blooded,
like,
Yeah, no, I really loved this episode. That was, that commitment to this character and that new species was high on the list.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say it goes back to this, and I think, you know, we mentioned it, the character development. It goes back to this show, you know, what we've been saying from episode one of, and I think Mando also shined in this episode with, you know, like I think of when he gets Baby Yoda back, right? And he's doing his little thing on the thing with the jetpack, and he just kind of shrugs at him. And it's this idea of, think about it. In this episode, we only saw three people, their faces, right? We saw the two X-Wing pilots and Pelimoto. That's it. Like, everybody else did not have a human face, and everybody was able to convey emotion. And I think that's just, if you told somebody that, like, hey, there's this show that, like, you only see a face, like, a couple times, but, like, everybody's great, people will be like, what kind of BS are you trying to sell? Like, but it really is amazing.
So a guy in a mask is interacting with a puppet and a motion caption actor, and it's awesome.
And there's spiders.
And they're all on green screen, just FYI.
And you gave a compliment to the motion capture person. I just wanted to definitely second that here. Like, the emotion that she was able to convey under complete CGI was just incredible.
Yeah. But I like the other thing that I liked a lot, aside from the X-Wings, was this continuation of this inconvenience that's very real. In the movies, nearly always you've got somebody there to translate, whether it's 3PO or whoever, there's a handy dandy droid that wipes out any sort of language barrier. And that's not the case here. And you see it play out in different ways. You've seen it with Mando being able to communicate uniquely with the sand people with this sort of sign language-esque language. And then you see it now where they start their journey. He's like, I don't speak that. And then he attempts to use a trade language in Huttese, like thinking maybe we have some common ground here. She doesn't. And sort of, they're sort of stuck until she kind of exercises, I guess, her technical genius and hacks into Zero's busted head and wakes him up in hilarious fashion.
Yeah.
Like, ready to start shooting. So that part, it's episodes like this, and I really dislike the knee-jerk reaction that some folks have had, that this is just like a filler episode, because I'm like, this is the meat and potatoes that makes Star Wars feel real. Like, this is, you know, it's these things that make it Star Wars. You know, if we don't get a massive leap forward in the story, that doesn't mean that it's not a great episode. So
I would add that it's the small storytelling that makes sense. That's radically important. Because if everything is, we have to stop the Death Star from blowing up a planet, like, that gets old fast. Because if everything's the Thanos level threat of extinction, then the stakes can't be that high all the time. This is getting from point A to point B. The cops stop them. They crash land, and there's spiders, and it's freezing. Like, this is, it's a very Western story. And I it's not True Grit, but it's that feeling of, okay, it's cold. All right, we got to get through that. Okay, we don't have like a singular gunfight with one bad guy. You know, it is literally they're on a journey, things keep going wrong, and the good guys show up at the end and they're still the good guys. Mm-hmm. And everyone goes on their merry way. It's like, it works for me.
Yeah.
And he's not some OP character that,
yeah,
that has a lightsaber and the Force, you know?
Yeah.
Mando too strong, nerf please.
Yeah. And what I like too about going to Tom's point about the translation, was not just that, you know, you see people trying to communicate with each other, but I liked the little kind of translator humor where Pelimoto, she gives the whole story and he's like, she said all that, and she's like, no, I'm paraphrasing. And it's like, that's what you do sometimes, like when you're translating for people, like you're like, I'm not gonna say, either they say like a whole bunch of stuff and you're like, that can be conveyed in like two sentences, or you know, they're leaving stuff out that you have to kind of fill in. And it's great. It's this kind of low level, you know, kind of very realistic humor. And it's just great.
I know we're running a little long. Oh, sorry. Sorry, Josh.
One thing I want to highlight just on a nerd level, Mando says, may the Force be with you. So,
yes.
So
that is some Catholic humor right there too.
And again, being Lutheran, I was giddy with that, and also with you. So the fact that, and also with you, is now canonized, I want to go hug whoever wrote that. So good job. I love you. I don't know you. And two, Mando now knows about the Force. And my fan theory is, maybe people have heard about the Force. It's just something people say. Like, people know what God is, but that doesn't mean you can quote the Bible at great length in being able to understand, well, let's talk about what the book of Deuteronomy actually means. And eyes are going to glaze over and someone's going to go, what was that? And like, because not everyone goes to church and has confirmation classes. Like, they don't have that. So my theory is Mando might have heard about the Force, but he didn't know it was magic that people could actually use.
Yeah, that's the thing, is I think he may have heard about it, but there's a difference between, like, you know, even reading a Bible and thinking, and then actually seeing someone, like, I don't know, walk on water or do something, like, that's a little different.
Yeah. Mando's like me the first few times I went to Mass, like, you hear the responsorial and you're like just a half second behind everybody, like, yeah, whatever they said.
Yeah.
No, well, I have one more thought. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Go ahead, Gabby.
I think that Mando doesn't know anything about the Force. I'm of the camp that this is something he's heard. You know, we know he's very well traveled. He clearly knows how to speak Sand People, Tusken Raider. So this is something he's heard, and he kind of used it to say, like, oh no, I'm just like you guys, like, may the Force be with you. And that's actually a call, historically, that there's different, like, language tests, which, if anybody wants, like, a very interesting story, the language tests in Haiti and the Dominican Republic, there's a great story called The Farming of Bones, which is great, of how they used to test if you were Dominican or if you were Haitian, by the way you said a certain word. But what I like too, before I wanted to mention this before I forget, is that I was so afraid with this season, and I don't know if you guys felt this way as well, I was so afraid when we were getting all those leaks of, you know, that Boba Fett was going to be in there, and Ahsoka Tano was going to be there, and Sabine Wren was going to be in it, and you know, all these canonical characters were going to be in season two. I was like, ah, great, we've gone, like, we have to go full Star Wars now, and like, this is, you know, it was going to lose that kind of very natural storytelling. And I mean we're only two episodes in. That could be the rest of the episodes that we get. But I like that they haven't gone, like, here's all these people, like, here's all these references, fans, you know, go Merry Christmas, you know?
Yeah, I agree completely. And I think that's why the folks that don't think that are the ones that are the loudest about being upset that this is a filler, because you, I think you had a certain expectation at the end of episode one that, hey, we're going to see this Boba Fett story play out. And quite frankly, I'm glad if all of these rumors play out that these are very small cameos, maybe they set up some other series. That's fine, because this show is The Mandalorian. It's about Din Djarin and his quest with the child. It's not the Boba Fett series, and it's not the Ahsoka series. And so far, I'm very glad to see that that's playing out, like you said, Gabby.
And I agree with everything that's been said. And Tom, thank you for bringing this back, because I know we're running along, Josh, but I just wanted to make this point because I was not with you guys for the podcast on season one. So I haven't been able to preach to you all about how I have seen The Mandalorian in general, as besides being a Western, as kind of a storytelling in the vein of like an epic poem. So like the Odyssey in particular, where, you know, there was an entire story arc to the Odyssey. Odysseus tries to go home, and at the end he goes home. But the story was mostly about this journey. The story was mostly about this journey, which took years, years and years and years. And the idea that, like, you know, you would have people complaining that he got stuck on the island of Calypso for a year, and oh wow, what a filler episode. It's just a little ridiculous. You know, I don't see the reason to rush to the conclusion here. For me, this storyline is about this journey, and I'm enjoying every moment of it.
I didn't realize this was everything I loved about Star Wars, and I'm eternally grateful for it. If I could have, you know, fun breakfast cereal while watching it, I would.
You can have that Baby Yoda cereal.
Right.
Tom said he has some Cheerios.
Yeah. Maybe. I have a little
baggie for you.
I appreciate that. You're very thoughtful. That said, I'm eternally grateful because it's written with love. It's written by people who understand the subject matter, who understand good storytelling. Like, we're not, they're taking their time. I agree with the Western or like a little Kurosawa. And it's all good.
Yeah, it's literally, you know, when Nari, when you said the epic poem, I thought of the Aeneid, you know, Arma viramque cano, you know, I sing of arms in a man. Sorry, I had to get that little Latin in there. But that's what it is. It's I sing of a child and a man. Like, that's The Mandalorian. Go watch the Obi-Wan Kenobi show if like you're so hurt about canonical Star Wars characters not being in there.
Yeah, it's okay to tell a new story. We have the technology. We can come up with new characters doing new things. And
hindsight is always 20/20. If you go back and literally, my best example and parallel is Star Wars Rebels. The idea and the move to bring in a character like Thrawn. If they had played that out in an episode arc or two, that would have been horrendous. It would have just done a disservice to that character. And instead, what we got was this great two-season slow burn where you have these little interactions with Thrawn. He's in an episode, he's not. He peeks in, and it builds to this great confrontation at the end. And it felt satisfying. We know that now with hindsight, but there were people that were complaining about the same sort of thing then. Like, this is a filler episode, blah, blah, blah. We're going to have the same hindsight when we get to the end of this season or maybe longer. I this entire creative team is taking very clearly a long view on this. This isn't a single mini series like Kenobi is going to be. This is at least through season three going to be a story that goes on, and that's how they're structuring it.
Works for me. So with that, everyone, thank you. It is a school night, and I'm the only one on the West Coast. So everyone, I want to thank you all who've watched live, those who listened to the recording, to our friend who peppered us with questions with her own deep historical knowledge as well to keep us on our toes tonight. So Gabby, Thomas, and Nari, thank you all. And everyone, stay safe and stay healthy.